Funding for this talk comes from TrialX, connecting patients to clinical trials.
Good evening and welcome to the 100th episode of Cure Talks. I'm Priya Menon, scientific media editor, Cure Talks, joining you from India. Cure Talks team takes this opportunity to thank our audience and participants for supporting us through all our 100 episodes. We hope you will continue with us on our journey towards another 100 more. With that note, we will begin with today's talk. Today, we are talking about prostate cancer. And the topic of discussion is, how will new imaging techniques and genomic tests help in diagnosis and management of prostate cancer? Our prostate cancer talks are conducted in association with Prostate Cancer International and Prostate Cancer Foundation. Recent advances in prostate cancer have led to the discovery of many new imaging and genomic tests. Information on the new tests and techniques can help patients in making informed decisions regarding their prostate cancer diagnosis, treatment, and management options, and thereby contribute towards managing their disease efficiently and effectively. We are talking to prostate cancer expert Dr. David Lee of University of Pennsylvania to better understand how the new techniques can help in making these decisions. Dr. Lee is chief of the Division of Urology at Penn Presbyterian Medical Center and associate professor of surgery, Division of Urology, University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. He specializes in robotic surgery, including robotic prostatectomy. Dr. Lee currently serves as an active member of the American Urological Association, the Endourological Society, and the American Medical Association. Dr. Lee has published over 100 articles, abstracts, and book chapters in the field of minimally invasive urology. Welcome to Cure Talks, Dr. Lee. It's a pleasure to have you with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
My co-host for the show is Mike Scott. Mike is co-founder and president of Prostate Cancer International, a prostate cancer-specific, a not-for-profit educational and informational organization based in Virginia. Mike is also a member of the board of directors of the National Organization for Rare Diseases and the International Myeloma Foundation. Supporting Mike on the panel, we have prostate cancer advocate Paul Carpenter. Paul has contributed to dozens of online groups and forums, and he co-founded a Los Angeles support group for gay and bisexual men living with prostate cancer. We also have Tony Crispino. Tony is a patient advocate at SWOG, where today he works with some of the industry's finest researchers on the latest clinical trials. An advanced disease survivor himself for over 6 years, Tony has run online discussion forums, live support groups, and is currently the president of US2 Las Vegas and a member of the American Society of Clinical Oncology. We have with us Meryl Gray Nissenberg. Meryl Gray is president of the National Alliance of State Prostate Cancer Coalitions, California Prostate Cancer Coalition, Mountain Foundation for Education Research in Lung Cancer. She's an attorney by profession. Her experience in advocacy work and community involvement is extensive. I extend a very hearty welcome to all the panelists. Before I hand over to Mike to begin with the discussion, I would like to remind our listeners that you can send in your questions to me at priya@trialx.com or post it on curetalks.com website. If you would like to ask a question live, please press 1 on your keypads and let us know. With that, Mike, it's over to you.
Thank you very much indeed, Priya, and welcome everybody. Dr. Lee, I think what we'd like to do is maybe give you about 15 minutes or so to just talk generally about how you are using new imaging and new genomic and other tests in order to give yourself and your patients the best idea of their risk factors and how that may influence their treatment. And then what we'll do is we'll take questions from the panel members, and for the last 15 minutes or so, we'll open the floor open to our people who are actually on the line. So with that, Dr. Lee, if you'd like to just take those 15 minutes and give us your opening thoughts, that would be very kind.
Oh, sure, Mike. Yeah, again, thanks for the invitation and the opportunity to talk about what's going on in prostate cancer and in my practice these days. I perform a pretty high volume of robotic prostate cancer surgery, and, you know, in dealing with this patient group, only 5 years ago, it was very cut and dry, very simple. There wasn't a whole lot else to do besides react to what the prostate biopsy showed, and that was typically only because somebody had an elevated PSA or an abnormal digital rectal exam. But recently, there's a whole variety of different options for patients, I think a lot of urologists included, besides patients, are trying to figure out exactly how we can best use these tools. I like to think about these different tools in different baskets, so to speak. There's the whole arena of, detection. And then once detected, you have a couple different tools that can help somebody to figure out what treatment option that they might want to undergo. There's the aspect of patient care, which involves post-surgery, and then what tests are available besides just the pathology report, which can help patients make a better informed decision. So in regards to imaging and genetic tests, which I believe we're going to focus mainly on today, I think one of the big things that's happened, a big step forward, is we have a little bit better imaging tests these days. I think multi-parametric MRI has really helped us to fine-tune our treatment decisions, help us to decide in some cases whether to do a biopsy and, maybe determine which patients are appropriate for active surveillance or more aggressive treatment. In our practice these days, when we see patients with more aggressive disease, so, you know, one of the pieces of information that we get from somebody's prostate biopsy is their Gleason score. And so knowing what somebody's Gleason score is really kind of the key to everything, because traditionally that gives us the best information on what somebody's prognosis is, based on that we can give them different treatment options. So if somebody has lower risk disease, then we start thinking about, especially if a patient is older and doesn't have a very long life expectancy, and a lot of talk these days is about a 10-year life expectancy. And so if a patient falls into a little bit older category, not so healthy category, with low risk prostate cancer, then active surveillance becomes a lot more viable treatment option. We really only had PSA, Gleason score to help us to make that determination. But one of the tools that we're using these days is multi-parametric MRI. And so it's a test where patients can go into the MRI scanner. The test usually lasts for about 45 minutes. There's different contrast agents involved, which can help give a picture of whether there's a solid tumor nodule within the prostate, what the blood flow characteristics are of that tumor. And, you know, in the realm of guys with less aggressive appearing disease, the MRI can give us some information. One of the things that it can help us to do, if there is actually a sizable tumor nodule in the prostate, then it's very likely that that tumor is actually a higher risk disease, so higher Gleason score. And so that can sway us to recommend more active treatment rather than active surveillance. If somebody has, no tumor visible on their MRI, that actually falls in line with guys with less aggressive disease. you know, even under the microscope, Gleason 6 disease really appears very similar to normal prostate tissue. And so it's not a big surprise that radiologically it's very difficult to distinguish this. And so, you know, on CAT scan, it's very difficult to get that information as to whether there's any, you know, distinct cancer there, even when it's high risk. But, you know, with MRI, we get a much better picture. And then in this kind of setting for guys with low-risk disease, there are two genetic tests that are now commercially available. One is called Prolaris, and that's made or run by a company called Myriad Genetics, and they're based out of Salt Lake City in Utah. And then the other test is Oncotype DX, and the company that provides that test is Genomic Health. And so these tests both aim to better characterize the aggressiveness of the prostate cancer. So, you know, one of the constraints that we had with Gleason score is that, you know, we know that 90%+ of guys who have Gleason 6 disease will do very, very well with treatment, you know, either with radiation or surgery. They'll have a very high success rate and not need any extra treatment afterwards. But, you know, there is that 10% of patients who won't do well. And, you know, some of those guys will go on to have metastatic disease and end up dying of their prostate cancer. So, you know, one of the things that we know is that not all men with Gleason 6 disease behave the same. And so there's something else going on that we can't really put a finger on until, you know, we have the help of some of these genetic tests. So the Prolaris test and both and the Oncotype DX test as well, they both work or are sampled by actually examining a piece of the biopsy tissue that was performed at the time of the standard prostate biopsy. And so these very small specimens can be obtained from the slide, and they only need about a 1 millimeter section of tumor, and then they can run these genetic tests. And so the idea with both of these tests is that they look for RNA expression in the cells. And so they can extract the RNA, which, you know, I think the technology in and of itself is really amazing. But then the Prolaris test, they look at 31 genes in particular, but these 31 genes are cell cycle proliferation genes. So they're more active or they're more upregulated in the arena or situation where the cells are more rapidly dividing. And so, you know, that goes along with aggressive cancer. The cells are dividing at a quicker pace. And so, you know, these tumors are, you know, more likely to spread. So looking at that result, if somebody has a higher Prolaris score, then that gentleman will have a more aggressive prostate cancer. The Oncotype DX test, they look at 17 genes, but these tests are looking at a whole, actually, variety of different cell functions. Some of them are androgen receptors, and so we know that prostate cancer is very sensitive to the presence of testosterone. And so, you know, obviously this would be important. There are some cell cycle proliferation genes that they look at, cellular organization genes. And then both of these tests also look at a set of reference genes. So, you know, kind of housekeeping genes that are turned on all the time. And so that's what you compare all of these other genes to. And so basically the higher the score, the more risk there is of an aggressive prostate cancer. The Prolaris test gives the information of actually mortality, which is interesting because it was validated by looking at a cohort of patients from Great Britain who chose to actually not do any aggressive treatment after they were diagnosed with prostate cancer and basically underwent a watchful waiting protocol. And, you know, knowing what the eventual outcome of these patients were, they were able to look at the test with the benefit of the tissue diagnosis and validate how well their tests actually function. The Oncotype DX looked at a different cohort of patients. A large cohort was from University of California, San Francisco. They looked at whether a little different outcome. They are looking at whether the patients on final pathology report, you know, if patients go ahead and get radical prostatectomy, what the chances are that their biopsy will look like what their pathology report looks like. And so, you know, if you have a higher score, then it's more likely that the patients will have more aggressive pathology. If you have a lower score, then that will correlate to a more favorable pathology on final pathology after surgery. The multiparametric MRI, I think, is also very valuable when patients have decided that they want surgery. I use it standardly on all the intermediate risk and high risk patients. And so these are the guys who would have a PSA greater than 10, a Gleason score of 7 or higher, or high volume disease. And this can be used as a really nice planning tool as to how much nerve saving we can do for the patients. These days in prostate cancer, we're dealing with a whole variety of different patients. There's a lot of the older gentlemen, which, you know, we traditionally identify with prostate cancer patients, but there's a lot of younger guys too, who are very worried about their quality of life, their potential for having urinary incontinence and erectile dysfunction. And so having this roadmap, so to speak, really gives me a better idea of what kind of operation that we can do as far as nerve sparing and preserving that kind of function.
Dr. Nathan, may I ask, do the results of these tests really, do you feel, help men to come to conclusions about whether they are good candidates for active surveillance? I mean, obviously, it's a problem for a lot of men in just, you know, taking that step to say, oh, I don't need to do anything yet.
Right. So I think that remains to be fully proven. There have been a couple studies looking at whether it influences physicians. And so when physicians are presented with case studies of patients, both with and without their genetic test results, the genetic test results actually do seem to influence the recommendation that the surgeon gives to the patient as to whether they need treatment or can do active surveillance. You know, it is a very, you know, this whole, you know, situation men find themselves in when they're at this point of trying to decide what treatment option to undergo or to do active surveillance. I feel really bad for a lot of these guys, because, you know, it's a very difficult decision to make. It has a lot of outcomes as far as their quality of life goes. And then, you know, they're looking at their whole issue of mortality. You know, is this something that's going to kill me or not? And so, you know, to choose to do active surveillance when you hear the diagnosis of cancer, it's a daunting task. But you know, I think if somebody can take the time to look at what the data means, I think the genetic tests actually do provide some really good information, because, you know, looking at these validation studies, the information that you get out of these studies actually has a very separate prognostic value when you compare it to Gleason score and PSA. And so, you know, I think a lot of us urologists, when we first started looking at these tests, we'd go, oh, well, how does it compare to PSA? How does it compare to Gleason score? And so if you see a genetic test result that's disconcordant from your Gleason score, then you're going to go, well, you know, this test doesn't really work because we know that Gleason score is such a powerful predictor. But, you know, these tests are actually telling us some separate information and, you know, can help us to really figure out these guys with Gleason 6 disease who look otherwise very low risk, but may actually be one of these guys who goes on and does poorly. I think that's another important point for men, is that you do have to take your time and figure out, you know, what the data means, what kind of tests are out there and available, because prostate cancer has really changed in treatment and diagnosis and testing.
And being based in Philadelphia, I assume you see African-American patients on a fairly regular basis. Is there any distinction in the use of these tests in that population, given that they do seem to be at higher risk to begin with?
Yeah, no, that's another area that hasn't been well studied. I think it's a very important area for us to look at because I think most of us who treat men with prostate cancer, if you just take an African-American guy who has this exactly the same numbers as somebody who's Asian or Caucasian or Hispanic, the African-American guy seems to do worse, you know, even with the same Gleason score, same PSA. And so, you know, there's got to be something else going on. And, you know, it's quite possible that one of these genetic tests can help us to pick out those guys a little bit more precisely.
So if it's okay with you, I'd like to offer the panelists a chance to ask you some questions. And being a gentleman, I'm going to ask ladies first. So, Meryl, do you have a couple of questions for Dr. Lee?
I hear a lot of patients telling me that – I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, I think I missed the first couple words. Yeah, but I can hear you
it's
now.
It's not a question. It's not a question per se, but it's a concern. I hear patients telling me that they haven't had a biopsy, but they've got a confirmed diagnosis of prostate cancer, and I take issue with that because I think it's a tissue-based diagnosis. And while the multiparametric MRI may be really helpful in deciding where to biopsy, I don't think it's appropriate to tell a patient he has prostate cancer based on simply the multiparametric MRI.
I couldn't agree with you more. You know, it's so important for us to know what somebody's Gleason score is, even if somebody has a PSA. And I'm actually seeing a patient right now in my clinic who his PSA is 150. His MRI shows invasion of a tumor into the seminal vesicles. He has enlarged lymph nodes on MRI. And, you know, we still absolutely need to have the tissue diagnosis to go ahead and, you know, start the appropriate treatment. And so, you know, I would never advise anybody to do anything until we have a prostate biopsy, which shows what's really going on. So I think that's a great point. Yeah, thank you.
Meryl, do you have another question?
Nope, that's it for now.
Okie dokie. Paul, what about you?
There is an issue. Thank you very much for being available to us, Dr. Lee. There's one question that comes up, a type of question, in support groups quite a lot, and I think as a physician you must face something similar, and that is how to communicate effectively with a patient who may be unable to grasp nuances of probability. They just want a black and white answer. And when the actual answer is, well, there's an 86% chance that if you continue on active surveillance, you'll live on into your 90s. But the
right.
patient doesn't understand what that means. Any suggestions?
It's a tough situation. I look at my role as an educator. I think it's so important to spend the time that it takes to really help somebody to figure out what all of this information means. But, yeah, you know, not everybody has the same experience level with looking at these types of things, and so it's it can be a challenge. But I think it can be as simple as trying to explain what somebody's batting average is in baseball. That can be a nice kind of understandable type of corollary that can help some guys to see what these percentages mean. I think there are a lot of guys who will really take the time to figure out, but then there are other guys who, they're just too nervous about it. I think it is the role of the physician to give the best advice that you can. If knowing what I know, I can help somebody to figure that out, even though they don't best understand it. If that's the way that I would treat my brother or myself or my dad, and I feel like that's really the best way to go, then, I think that behooves everybody to advise patients who have a difficult time figuring things out on their own.
Well, I understand. Do you mind if I ask a follow-up question?
Oh, please do, yeah.
I was a little surprised when you said that 90% of Gleason 6 patients will have no problem, but the 10%, and I had thought the figures were closer to 98% and 2%, which makes quite a difference, I would think. I wonder if you could comment on that or if maybe I've got my facts wrong.
Yeah, no, I think it's Gleason score is very important, but I think it depends on what kind of time frame that you're looking at. I think the 98% is very applicable for the 5-year time frame, that's probably a more accurate number than the 90%, but the 90% I use very often to just help patients to realize that they have a really high percentage chance. I think sometimes if you paint an over rosy picture, it can be difficult for patients to appreciate that. You may not have a good outcome.
Right.
For those patients who do have a bad outcome, it's 100% for them. That really kind of clouds everything and makes it really difficult for those patients to understand sometimes.
So, we are, I think, for clarification for the audience, talking both about the risk of upgrading between biopsy and actual surgical procedure, if surgery is what is carried out, and also quite separately the risk that a Gleason 6 cancer will progress to Gleason 7 over time. Is that correct, Dr. Lee?
Yeah, and then another, I think another point that I could make to address your question was that, the guys who we do the operation for who have a Gleason 6 on their initial biopsy, when we get their final pathology reports, they'll end up with a Gleason 7 afterwards, a good 35% of the time. So, I think I'm framing my reference point more to the biopsy outcome rather than the final pathology report outcome. Yeah, because when I talk to patients about their final pathology reports, if they have a Gleason 6 on their final pathology report, then I'll tell them they're a 95% to 98% chances of being great at 10 years. But with such a significant upgrading percentage that we see for guys with Gleason 6, I think that changes your overall percentage of guys who walk in your door with a biopsy report that shows a Gleason 6.
I absolutely understand. I entered a surgery with a Gleason 7 and a pathology report said Gleason 9, which was something of a shock for me.
Yeah, right. Yeah. We definitely have had our share of those guys too. So it's really.
Thank you.
So
No, thank you.
Thank you, Paul. Tony, do you have a couple of questions?
Yes, I do. Again, echoing Paul's comment, thank you, Dr. Lee, for coming on the show. My questions are going to run into a little bit more of the genetic biomarkers that we have, the exciting new genetic biomarkers that we have, and we're seeing them used in a great deal of access prior to an active therapy to make a determination
yes.
that the patient is maybe a good candidate for active surveillance or more likely for aggressive. And then also to come back on around after the prostatectomy. During the post-prostatectomy, do you use these tests on the sample tissue, and where do you use that information if you do?
Right. No, and thanks for asking that question. You know, I didn't, in my little opening remarks, I didn't get to talk about the post-prostatectomy setting. And we do, for you know, all the high-risk guys, get them a genetic test afterwards. And your two options in that arena right now are the Prolaris test, which we talked about for the biopsy situation, but then also the Decipher score. And so the Decipher score, I think, it's a very interesting test. The company uses a chip which actually tests for 1.4 million different gene products, but they've found 22 in particular, which can help stratify the guys into different, you know, chances for having metastatic disease in the long run. So we order one or the other test for all the high-risk guys and a good number of the intermediate-risk guys when we see that on their final pathology reports. And so we use that information quite a bit to help guide the patients to decide whether they want to do actively follow their PSA or do adjuvant radiation or do salvage radiation, you know, by continuing to monitor their PSA and see how that progresses over time.
Beck, on the genetics again here, it's an exciting new field that we're finding over at SWOG, where we're taking the outcomes of some of the large trials that SWOG has been able to do, such as the SELECT trial, the PCPT trial, going back on over and reviewing backwards at and reflecting on outcomes and perhaps hopefully identifying hypotheses for specific genes for specific patients. Do you guys participate in that type of activity as well? I mean, I know we do on the reflection side here, but perhaps prospectively, what are you guys doing?
Yeah, so we're keeping. So I have a database of our, you know, 4,500 guys that I've performed robot prostatectomy for, and we're following all of these guys who have had the genetic testing. We have an active tumor tissue banking program as well, which we could potentially get information out of. And so, yeah, we're trying to prospectively collect this data.
Okay, thank you very much.
So, Dr.
Okay. Hey,
I'm curious. You mentioned the use of either adjuvant or salvage radiation in high-risk patients. The general perception seems to be that we are starting to see a great deal less adjuvant therapy and a great deal more very early salvage therapy in people being monitored with ultra-sensitive PSAs. Does the Decipher test help you to tell who really does need the immediate adjuvant radiation?
Yeah, no, so this is one of the most interesting studies that has come out regarding the genetic tests recently. The Decipher test was looked at for a group of patients from the Mayo Clinic and at Jefferson who underwent prostatectomy and then either underwent adjuvant or salvage radiation because they had high-risk features. And the Decipher score was actually able to show that guys who had very high-risk features did better when they got adjuvant radiation versus early salvage radiation. So yeah, so it's interesting, interesting information. I think it needs to be validated on a bigger scale, because I think it was still only about less than 100 patients in the study. But yeah, I think this is a potential potential aid to help guys to figure out whether, you know, they should, you know, undergo that adjuvant radiation.
And the other thing that interests me is we are starting, I mean, with the coming of the 11 choline PET CT scans and some other forms of imaging that are becoming available, we're starting to see the possibility of being able to look at patients' pre-treatment to decide whether, you know, surgery is even a good idea at all, or if done, should be done in combination with hormone therapy or whatever, for men who might have small, very small amounts of cancer that have already reached the lymph nodes or even other areas in the pelvis. Do you have any
right.
experience yet with using some of these new tests in scenarios like that?
Yeah, so we so at Penn we've started using the sodium fluoride PET scans on a limited basis. I think the you know, the pictures that we obtain are really, they're really beautiful, but as to actually altering treatment decisions, so far we haven't really come to that point yet. You know, one of the things that we are seeing recently, I think it's because of the decrease in screening that's gone on over the past few years, is that we're starting to see more guys with higher risk disease pop up. And so I think there is an increased interest for these guys with high risk disease, though, to go ahead and get radical prostatectomy, even in the face of low volume oligometastatic disease, or, you know, some enlarged lymph nodes which may be suspicious for metastatic disease, but, you know, with extended lymph node dissections, we can potentially remove those lymph nodes. There have been some small case reports which show that men do very well for many years, even in the face of high-risk disease in this setting. So I think the indications for surgery may be slightly expanding with this increase in high-risk patients that we're seeing.
And I suspect that I'm not the only panelist who's seen at least a couple of papers on new forms of technique that will actually allow highlighting of cancer or of cancerous areas. One might call it glowing in the dark,
right?
As a method to actually improve the quality of surgery. Are you familiar with any of those techniques?
Yeah, so you know, we use a similar type of technique for kidney tumors with fluorescent. So it's called ICG. You can inject that into patients during your robotic partial nephrectomy, and then with the aid of the laser fluorescence technology that's built into the robot, typically the kidney tumors will be slightly less vascular. So then you can actually see as you approach the tumor whether you're getting too close. With prostate cancer, it's, you know, I think the benefit, potential benefit would be if you could give somebody some type of immunofluorescence, which would actually tag on to PSMA that's expressed on the surface of prostate cancer cells, inject that preoperatively, and then allow that to, you know, go through the body and potentially latch onto lymph nodes that have small volume prostate cancer, and then using a similar type of laser fluorescence and actually visualize where these small tumor deposits are. I think we're still a ways away from that. I think there are actually other organ systems like kidney where this is actually being used clinically, but for prostate, you know, to have a definable target that's very reliable. We're still not there yet, unfortunately. But, yeah, the technology is getting there.
Okay, well, I think at this point what we'll do is I'll pass the mic back to Priya, so to speak, and she can see if we can take some of the questions from the audience that's on the phone.
Okay, great.
Thank you, Mike. Audience, if you have a question for Dr. Lee, please press 1 on your keypads and let us know, and we can bring you on air to ask your question. Dr. Lee, we've got a list of questions being posted on our website as you have been talking. I will just read them off from the website so that maybe there may be some repetitions of what we have already spoken, but I just read them out. The first question is, Gleason classification is subjective. Should biopsy tissues be sent to an expert prostate pathologist to confirm Gleason score?
We're fortunate to work at a center where we have expert pathologists. I think that that's an excellent idea. The more experienced your pathologist is, I think the better diagnosis you will get. I think academic centers have shown that they have fewer incidences of upgrading at time of prostatectomy, and so this is a great idea.
Thank you, doctor. The next question is, what is the rate of occurrence in these genetic tests, if any, of results indicating lower risk in the case of higher Gleason scores?
Yeah, so that's an interesting point. We have been typically reserving active surveillance for guys with Gleason 6 disease and low volume disease, but I think there are some people who are starting to extend that indication to guys with low volume Gleason 7 disease. And so if you study some of these validation tests looking at the Oncotype DX and the Prolaris test, there actually tends to be more separation between the test scores for the Gleason 7 disease patients rather than the Gleason 6 disease patients. And so some of these guys with Gleason 7, according to the genetic tests, are going to be, as indolent as some of the Gleason 6 prostate cancers. And so the relative percentage is small, but the test does seem to pick these gentlemen out. So for somebody who is really considering active surveillance, they have low volume intermediate risk disease, a genetic test may be worthwhile to see if they could potentially be an active surveillance candidate.
Thank you, doctor. The next one is, do those of us with artificial hip joints not qualify for the MRI scans due to the metal and the artificial hip implant? Doesn't the metal scatter the MRI signal and ruin the results?
Right. We still order the MRI for patients with hip replacements. The picture doesn't come out as clearly, not as well defined, but I think we still get a really good study for most of the patients and can get some valuable information.
The next one is, with recurrent prostate cancer, how frequently should full body bone scans be done when no mets are found? Annually, twice per year, or some other?
So in the situation where after treatment, after surgery, we just follow the PSAs. And if somebody's PSA is undetectable, then we won't usually do any further imaging. For gentlemen who are undergoing active surveillance, we'll typically not do any bone scans. I have been ordering MRIs periodically for these guys on top of the PSAs and the regular biopsies that they should undergo. But again, no regular bone scan schedule.
Thank you. Where can one obtain a genomic test? Does Medicare approve it?
So Medicare does approve the Prolaris test, and I think they're very close with the Decipher test. It may be now covered. So as far as I know, there are no private insurances that cover either of those tests, but Medicare, I think, is covering both of those. As far as how to obtain one, patients can ask their physicians to order it for them. The way that it typically runs is the order goes into the company, and then the company will contact the laboratory where the prostate biopsy is sitting, the actual slides. And so, depending on whether there's a relationship there already, there may be some lag time to, set up all the contracting that way. But if there's a contract set up, then, the slides will go out very shortly, and then we usually get turnaround in around 2 or 3 weeks as far as the test results go. And then that test result comes back to the ordering physician, and then the physician can review the test results with the patient then.
Thank you. What is the ideal PSA number that a man should achieve before attempting either C11 choline or acetate imaging?
For PET scans, it's a continuous spectrum that there will probably be very few gentlemen who have a positive PET scan with a PSA less than 1. It'll probably be closer to 5 where you will actually see some activity on a PET scan. It would probably be, a minimum of 1. But that I think makes it a little bit more difficult to use as a decision-making tool because in the situation where somebody has a early recurrence after prostatectomy, then the guys will usually get salvage radiation, well before their PSA hits 1. So,
Dr. Lee, speak to that. I'm sorry. From personal experience.
Yes, sure, Paul. Please go ahead.
Okay, thanks. I underwent C11 choline imaging, but I was told at the time, this was 4 years ago, that I needed to have a PSA of 2 or above to qualify.
Yeah.
So I deliberately allowed my PSA to rise to that level so that the imaging would be better. Has that changed in the 4 or 5 years since I did that?
So did you have surgery first?
Oh, this was after surgery, after radiation,
yes.
After
ADT. After surgery. Gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay. I think that would be what most people would recommend. I've seen a study or two where they say that they can see some patients who have a positive PET scan at a PSA of only 1, but I don't think we would typically order it still in that setting. It would probably be more at a level of closer to 5.
I see.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
So we have about another 10 minutes. Perhaps do any of the panel have any other questions they'd like to ask Dr. Lee?
Oh, you know me. I always have a lot of questions.
Oh, go right ahead.
Something Tony asked caused me to think of something. How many years after a prostatectomy has been performed can genetic testing be of use? For example,
my tissue
is from 2007. Could I get a genetic test now?
It's probably just a hair late now. Companies, generally say that up to 5 years, they can still get very, very reproducible data.
Oh, that's fascinating. Okay, thank you for that. I had no idea.
Sure. It's really interesting technology, and I think we're going to, learn to use this better and better over time. And then as people get more comfortable with the idea that these tests are out there, then, everybody will feel more comfortable with it and figure out how to use it appropriately.
Sure.
So, Dr. Lee, there are now several of these tests are on the market, several more in development. Are you concerned in any way that we have no head-to-head data on the relative quality of these tests?
Right. Yeah. Still, as far as these three tests go, that still isn't there yet. You know, I think what is going on is, like the Decipher test is really just focused at the post-prostatectomy setting, but now they're starting to build their case to be used as a biopsy decision-making tool. Likewise, the Oncotype test now is just for the biopsy setting, but they're working to develop their data to be used in the post-prostatectomy setting. That's really what people are working on. You know, we are actually ordering a lot of these tests for the high-risk guys, both the Prolaris and the Decipher, and hopefully we'll accrue some data which will give us some idea whether one is better than the other or more predictive than the other. The test results are still, they have their own definitions as far as what they're predicting. So it's a little bit difficult to compare them one-on-one.
Any other questions for the panel? Meryl?
Well,
nope.
To that last
excellent
oh,
presentation.
Go ahead.
I was going to say an excellent presentation. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your questions.
Tony?
I did have one follow-up question.
Go for it.
Yeah, please.
Okay. do the tests, current genomic tests currently on the market, give an indication as to which drugs might be more effective or less effective for those of us with advanced prostate cancer? Like, we've not yet progressed to extend the enzalutamide. It might work, might not. Do we take the chance? Does a genetic test maybe help?
Yeah, no, I think that's a huge area of future research. Because this whole idea that Vice President Biden now is heading up as far as the moonshot for cancer cure goes.
More power to him.
It's going to be, I think, a lot of personalized medicine where you really hone in on the genetics of what's going on with a particular patient's cancer, and then really tailor the treatment to that patient. Because cancer formation and proliferation is really such a personalized event. You know, there are certain genetic pathways which are mutated, but they're probably very different from patient to patient. So looking at what the specific defect, so to speak, is, I think is going to be very important, and it's really going to help us to figure out, you know, whether a patient may benefit from a certain type of radiation or a certain dosage of radiation or, you know, what kind of hormonal therapy that they would work well with, or what type of chemotherapy plus or minus hormone therapy that the patients would do best with. So this whole field for prostate cancer genetics, I think, is, it's just starting. It's very much behind the times compared to, like, breast cancer, where, you know, there's really actionable data as far as, you know, what type of therapies to administer to women based on what their genetic profile looks like. But hopefully with these new tests coming out, we're going to make an impact this way.
Understood. So not yet, but soon, we think. Thank you.
Hopefully,
I think that as time we move along, we're going to continue to see more uses of the genomics and the definitions of translational medicine and into drug sequencing. I think that's kind of what you were summarizing right there, Dr. Lee. And I think that perhaps there's got to be a starting point someplace, and I know that it's back to those tissue depositories and trying to look at outcomes and see if we can find genetic markers. Let me ask you a question. Do you feel, how long do you think it would take for us to come up with perhaps a nice way to break down a lot of the genetic biomarkers that we see down out there and actually start to see some of these translational medicines hitting the street?
It might not take that long. I think that one of the big hurdles these days just is uncertainty, you know, as to what genes are really important as far as targeting goes. Some of the immunotherapy agents, have some promise, but then, where do they function? Where do they target? As far as the Decipher test goes, it's interesting. Some of the genes that they look at, which they found, which are very correlated to poor outcomes in the long run, they're not really even certain how these genes impact the cancer. And so trying to figure out this tangle, so to speak, of cellular function and where things have gone astray is very perplexing. And then, as far as prostate cancer goes, there's such a preponderance towards low-risk prostate cancer that it's hard to figure out then, which of the guys who really need to be treated aggressively, the guys with high risk, what are the specific, genes which, lend more towards less aggressive disease and more towards the high risk disease, and then to target those things specifically. So, I think it's this informational gap that exists.
So, Dr. Lee, I think we've reached pretty much the end of our hour, and I would really like to thank you on behalf of all of the panel and the audience for your time this evening. I hope that you've enjoyed speaking with us, and I'm going to hand us back to Priya to close out the rest of the program. So thank you very much for your time.
Great. Now, thank you. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Lee, thank you very much for that very informative session. Mike, Tony, Paul, and Meryl, thank you for your participation. This talk will be made available on CureTalk's website along with its transcript. Please visit curetalks.com for details of upcoming talks. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, everyone. Good night.
Thank you for hosting.
Thank you.
Good night.